Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present David Wright of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who examines the Bush administration's response to recent revelations that North Korea maintains a covert nuclear weapons program. Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive, who talks about the recent historic conference in Havana on the 40th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And Debbie Weinstein with the Children's Defense Fund, who discusses the critical issues facing poor families as Congress debates reauthorization of the 1996 Welfare Reform Act. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
When it joins the European Union in 2 years, Poland may be forced to give up its traditional reliance on the family farm. 2 million farmers could face the onslaught of cheap food imports from Western Europe that are heavily subsidized by their governments. Today, Poland employs 20% of its people in the agricultural sector. That will likely shrink when Poland joins the EU. In 1986, Portugal joined the common European market and lost 30% of its farming jobs. Farm activists now worry that 1.2 million Polish farmers may have to abandon their small plots in the face of massive food imports. Jadwiga Lopata, an organic farmer near Krakow and winner last spring of the Goldman Environmental Prize, fears a purge of family farmers will alter Poland's traditional way of life and break many community bonds. She also says it will weaken biodiversity and harm food quality. For small farmers to survive, Lopata, co-founder of the International Coalition to Protect the Polish Countryside, said we must start using organic growing practices. So far, 130 eco-farms have started up in Poland, and the organic farms now earn 20% of their income from tourists. District Judge Jim Parsons, a Democratic candidate for the Texas Supreme Court, is dialing for campaign dollars. He now spends all his spare time calling up lawyers and asking for contributions. It's the most outward sign that state judicial elections, usually low-key, are changing rapidly into bitter and divisive contests. A recent U.S. Supreme Court decision now allows judicial candidates to make public comments on issues like abortion. According to The Nation magazine, business interests are now pouring millions of dollars into state judicial elections through ads on hot issues like tort reform and environmental protection. The new campaign cash is coming from the likes of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Koch Industries, Home Depot, Walmart, and the American Council of Life Insurers. In the 2000 election, there was a 61% increase in political contributions to state Supreme Court candidates. Corporate interests gave $25 million in undisclosed donations to gain favorable decisions on capping awards and personal injury lawsuits. 2 years ago, well-funded business interests in Ohio went after state Supreme Court Justice Alice Roby Resnick, who wrote the majority decision to strike down the state's new tort reform law. Business groups funded attack ads that some observers say bordered on character assassination. Yet Resnick won easily as voters rebelled against the harsh ads. This year, Ohio business groups are back in gear, trying to alter the 4-3 court majority that defended consumer rights. Las Vegas has prospered by promoting itself as America's Sin City. It was one of the first places to legalize gambling and permits prostitution to thrive as part of Nevada's live and let live attitude. Now Nevada voters are considering the next step, legalizing possession of up to 3 ounces of marijuana for personal use. On November 5th, voters will determine the fate of a constitutional amendment proposed by Nevadans for Responsible Law Enforcement, a spin-off of the Marijuana Policy Project. Under the amendment, state-licensed stores will be able to sell pot to adults and sales would be heavily taxed. Smoking of marijuana would be banned in public places, and transporting marijuana out of state would be illegal. According to the news magazine In These Times, Las Vegas police and their unions are campaigning against the initiative, saying it would lead to more traffic accidents and higher insurance rates. White House drug czar John Walters has blasted the amendment, saying it would turn Nevada into a vacation state for drug traffickers. In response, amendment organizer Billy Rogers quipped that people in Nevada are sick and tired of the federal government coming in and telling us what to do. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Thank you.
As Congress debated a resolution in early October to provide President Bush the authority to take military action against Iraq, the White House kept secret for 12 days a North Korean admission that it was pursuing a covert nuclear weapons program. But when the administration publicly responded to North Korea's nuclear project with a call for quiet diplomacy, critics raised questions about the consistency of U.S. policy. Contrasting Mr. Bush's measured approach to Pyongyang with his demand for regime change in Baghdad through military force. George W. Bush came into office openly hostile to a 1994 agreement between the U.S. and North Korea, which provided Western energy assistance to the impoverished nation in exchange for a pledge from leader Kim Jong-il to freeze his government's effort to develop nuclear weapons. North Korea admitted to maintaining a covert nuclear program only after U.S. officials confronted them with evidence that they were in violation of the agreement. But Pyongyang, labeled by the U.S. as part of an axis of evil, placed the blame on the U.S. for taking steps which forced them to nullify the accord. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with David Wright, co-director of the Union of Concerned Scientists Global Security Program, who examines the Bush administration's response to North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons and the effectiveness of U.S. policies on limiting the global proliferation of weapons of mass destruction.
The Clinton administration in 1994 sat down with the North Koreans and apparently managed to avert military action. I mean, it sounds like we were very close to having some sort of military conflict on the peninsula by negotiating what was called the agreed framework. The agreed framework was far from perfect. It had a lot of problems, but it was quite successful in shutting down a plutonium production reactor that the North Koreans had running, taking the spent fuel from that reactor, putting it in cans, and essentially putting them under lock and key so that the nuclear material could not be taken out of those and made into bombs. And that's fairly significant because estimates are that those fuel rods contain enough plutonium for sort of 5 to 10 nuclear weapons. And those rods remain to this day canned and have not been touched by North Korea. Now, what appears to have happened in the meantime is that North Korea was looking at a second route toward nuclear weapons, which was to try and get the technology needed to make what's called highly enriched uranium, which is a second material you can make nuclear weapons out of. My understanding is that sort of technology actually was not covered by the agreed framework. So there's some interesting history here that goes back, and I don't think anyone knows when this program actually started or how far along it is. What's been said is that there are indications that there was technical assistance from Pakistan that probably started, I don't know, 5 to 8 years ago, maybe longer ago than that. But it sounds like this has been in the works for some time. I think there are two things that are interesting to point out, or maybe three things. The first is that nobody really knows how far along this program is. The second is, I think it's quite interesting that the U.S., in fact, was able to detect this program that North Korea was obviously trying to hide, which, again, is a hopeful sign for those of us who like to think about verification and monitoring. And the third one is this whole question of why North Korea would have announced its program. I think the latter question may well have been a combination of things. It may have been that they were confronted with evidence that the U.S. knew about it and simply decided that there was no reason to try and hide that anymore. There's irrefutable evidence. But I think it's also very possible that North Korea is now at a point where they are trying to figure out how to get economic integration with the international community, and putting this on the negotiating table they see as both an incentive for negotiations and also something to put on the negotiating table because they have very little to put there.
There are some observers who view the different treatment that Iraq and North Korea are receiving as attributable to the possibility that North Korea has nuclear weapons, whereas Iraq is thought not to possess them, and that nations that do possess nuclear weapons or are thought to have them receive a lot more respect and moderation in terms of the rhetoric coming from the White House. What do you say?
I'm sure that's true to some extent. I mean, the prospect of a country armed with nuclear weapons is obviously something that causes you to try and figure out how you're going to handle it. The North Korean situation is somewhat different as well, though, because quite aside from its ability to cause trouble with nuclear weapons, it can launch a conventional attack that would essentially destroy Seoul, the capital of South Korea, which is quite close to the border with North Korea. So there's a lot of concern about what would the result be for South Korea and Japan in particular if there were a conflict in that area. And so I think that's clearly also in the minds of people who are looking at the situation.
What has the Bush administration contributed to the overall effort to limit the proliferation of nuclear weapons with their policies since taking office? Have they been helpful in terms of sending signals to the rest of the world that possession of nuclear weapons in this day and age is not a desirable thing, or have those messages been somewhat opposite of their desired outcome?
Well, I think the Bush administration has sent a couple very strong messages which go in exactly the wrong direction, the most notable of which, I think, is the Nuclear Posture Review. That is a review that the Bush administration did of U.S. nuclear policies, in which they essentially reemphasized the importance of nuclear weapons for the U.S. arsenal, not only saying that they were a key part of sort of our last line of defense, but talking about integrating them with conventional forces, about the idea of developing new weapons, developing weapons that could be used on a conventional battlefield. So it seems to me that the Bush administration was sending the signal not only that nuclear weapons could be quite useful tools in terms of military conflict, but that a country, even with the overwhelming conventional might of the United States, still needed nuclear weapons for its defense. And that would seem to me to send to almost any other country the signal that essentially everybody needs nuclear weapons if they're concerned about their security. You know, one of my concerns about the Bush administration is that I think they need to be careful, for example, not to back North Korea into a corner and to overreact to, again, what I think is a fairly ham-handed attempt by North Korea to engage the United States in negotiations. The Bush administration, if it tries to be too confrontational, if it tries to be too rigid, it's likely in the North Korean case to make things worse. And I hope that cooler heads prevail and that they take seriously the possibility that with diplomacy on the Korean Peninsula, they could actually end up in a much more secure situation than we have today.
That was David Wright, co-director of the Union of Concerned Scientists Global Security Program. Contact the Union of Concerned Scientists at area code 617-547-5552 or visit their website at www.ucsusa.org. On October 10th, senior veterans of the Cuban Missile Crisis arrived in Havana for a historic 40th anniversary conference. Among the attendees were former U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, CIA analyst Dino Brugioni, and JFK counsel and speechwriter Theodore Sorensen. Russian veterans also arrived from Moscow, including Deputy Foreign Minister Georgi Kornienko and former Defense Minister Dmitry Yazov. Thousands of documents have recently been declassified from the Cuban government, the CIA, the Pentagon, the Soviet Foreign Ministry Politburo, Mexico, Canada, and Great Britain, providing for the first time a multinational perspective on the crisis. During the conference, it was revealed that President John F. Kennedy, in meetings with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev's son-in-law Azhube in January 1962, compared the U.S. failure at the Bay of Pigs to the Soviet invasion of Hungary in 1956. Kennedy also assured Azhube that the United States will not meddle with Cuba, while at the same time, Joint Chiefs of Staff were preparing cover and deception plans that included pretexts for a U.S. invasion of the island nation. Peter Kornbluh is with the National Security Archive and directs the Archive's Cuba project. He spoke with your reporter, Denise Manzari, about the significance of recently declassified documents and the role the conference could play in helping to prevent a future nuclear crisis.
The conference in Cuba really had three main objectives. One was to put Cuba front and center into the Cuban Missile Crisis. For 40 years, the scholarly work on the missile crisis has basically treated Cuba as a territorial chessboard for the superpowers. The second objective of the conference was really to advance our understanding of this extraordinarily important event. This could be the single most important event in the history of the Cold War, the one moment during the Cold War when the world, as Theodore Sorensen and aides John F. Kennedy put it, the world looked down the gun barrel of nuclear warfare. And it's taken 40 years for us to even approximate an understanding of what really happened. And the third reason for holding the conference was really to apply the lessons and air the lessons of the missile crisis for today's world and for the future. And obviously the Cuban Missile Crisis is being batted around now as a political football by George Bush and arguments to invade Iraq.
It's reported to have been 13 crucial days. So the Cubans look at it as the entire month of October and into November, more like a month of a crisis. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and also how this new information basically changes the historical path we have been taking for 40 years?
One of the biggest myths of the Cuban Missile Crisis is that it only lasted 13 days. Those 13 days date from October 16th, when President John Kennedy was informed that there were missiles in Cuba, to October 28th, when Nikita Khrushchev, the premier of the Soviet Union, decided to withdraw the missiles under great pressure from the United States and in response to a public agreement by John Kennedy to no invasion pledge of Cuba, as well as a secret agreement with John Kennedy that the United States would withdraw U.S. missiles in Turkey if the Soviet Union withdrew the missiles in Cuba. The truth is that the missile crisis, from the Cuban perspective, began months and months and months before October 16th. It began with U.S. efforts through the CIA to overthrow and assassinate Fidel Castro, certainly accelerated with the invasion at the Bay of Pigs in April of 1961. And when the Soviets, for their own reasons, came to Cuba in May of 1962 and said, "We think you're going to be invaded before the November congressional elections in the United States," the Cubans agreed to their proposal to put missiles into Cuba. Certainly, as we learned last week in Cuba, that the crisis did not end on October 28th. In fact, it escalated again in November. The Cubans asserted their own objectives. They did not accept the Soviets' withdrawal of the missiles for a simple verbal guarantee of their security. They wanted something far more firm. They believed that the Soviets had abandoned them and that they'd left them in an even more vulnerable position to U.S. attack than before.
What about the significance of Robert McNamara being there, as well as Theodore Sorensen? Do you want to talk a little bit about their presence and input to this conference?
Theodore Sorensen put it at the conference, it was more than a remembrance, it was a reconciliation. And just the mere ability to sit around a conference table and speak in a very civil way about the most hostile and acrimonious of historical events, I thought was extremely symbolic, not only for the issue of conflict resolution, but also for the future of U.S.-Cuban relations. As Robert McNamara pointed out at this conference, U.S. officials simply did not think through the future of their actions, and that certainly is something that U.S. officials need to do today as they plot for future courses of actions around the world.
October 22nd is also a significant date in that President Kennedy basically announced to the American people, I believe, the presence of the missiles in Cuba.
That is right. The Kennedy administration then shared the intelligence that it had, which consisted of extremely detailed reconnaissance photography, making a dramatic and forceful case to prove that the Soviets had surreptitiously smuggled these weapon systems into Cuba, deceptively misrepresenting what they were doing to the president and his advisors the entire time. It was this deception that really created the tension in the Cuban Missile Crisis. As a number of people pointed out, including Fidel Castro and Arthur Schlesinger and Theodore Sorensen during this conference, if Nikita Khrushchev had simply openly put these missiles into Cuba under then-existing international law, as the Cubans wanted him to do, they could have done so at the time, and the Cuban Missile Crisis would have certainly evolved in a very different direction.
It's the 40th anniversary. Will there be a 50th? Is this laid to rest at this point, the post-crisis mentality and the fact that all of these documents have been declassified? Where does the Cuban Missile Crisis go from here in a historical viewpoint?
I think new lessons will be drawn from the more accurate accounting of this history, and hopefully those lessons will be applied to both our present policy debate over Iraq and other countries in a world of mass destruction, and hopefully apply to the issue of nonproliferation and indeed the destruction of nuclear weapons, so that the world will never face a crisis like this again.
That was Peter Kornbluh, director of the National Security Archives Cuba Project. For more information on the Cuban Missile Crisis and the National Archive, call area code 202-994-7000 or visit their website at www.nsarchive.org. The 1996 Federal Welfare Reform Law ended 60 years of welfare as we know it. It created a five-year lifetime limit on support to poor families and gave the states a lot of leeway to design programs and establish income levels. 5 years after the legislation was signed into law by President Clinton, the number of people on welfare in the U.S. has dropped by half. Advocates for the poor say the law has pushed women into low-wage, dead-end jobs, many without adequate daycare for their young children or health care. And while supporters of the law claim the 50% drop in caseloads is proof that reform is working, critics counter statistics prove only that the law is effective at cutting people off from the welfare rolls. The welfare reform law, set to expire on September 30th, was scheduled for reauthorization this year, but President Bush signed a stopgap measure to continue funding through December 30th. Meanwhile, the House has passed a bill that requires women on welfare to work a minimum of 40 hours a week to receive benefits while providing minimal child care and negligible funds for training. The Senate is working on its own less severe version, which mandates a 30-hour-a-week work requirement, counts education toward work hours, and provides more funds for child care. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Debbie Weinstein, director of the Family Income Division with the Children's Defense Fund, about the critical issues facing poor families and changes to the law her group is advocating.
Right now, under current law, parents with children are expected to work 30 hours a week, and if they have a child under six, 20 hours a week. And I should say states have the flexibility to require more. All this is saying that if that's all that's required, it will count towards the federal work participation rates. And states have to meet these rates. If they don't, they'll lose federal dollars. So that's current law. And the new proposal that passed in the House would raise the hours of work participation to 40 hours. And without an exception for parents with very small children. Now, many people say, I work 40 hours a week, that's full-time, why shouldn't they? We're not talking about a real job where people leave welfare. That's what we all want. This is filling out the clock with activities that will add up to 40 hours. And what that means is in order for states to meet those requirements, they're going to have to come up with, you know, as I say, make work or workfare type activities where people aren't in real jobs, and those make work activities do not tend to result in people getting placed in real jobs. And they cost a fair amount of money to implement.
Is there still the five-year lifetime limit that's going to be in place? Is that going to change at all?
It doesn't change. It's part of the current law, and nothing would be changing it in any of the proposals that are before Congress.
The statistics, I guess, show that nationally there's about 50% fewer women with children on welfare than there was in 1996 when this first law was first passed. People are using that to call the welfare reform a success, but I know there's a lot of, at least anecdotal information out there that a lot of those people are still struggling desperately. They may be off welfare, but they're still poor. Do you have any data to show what's happened to those people?
We do know some things, quite a lot at this point. You're certainly right. The caseload was cut in half since the welfare law was originally passed in 96. We know that about two-thirds to three-quarters of the families that left welfare worked at least at some point. But we also know that very frequently their jobs were unstable and they didn't all that often work full-time year-round. We know that earnings were low, and actually about half of the families that left welfare had family incomes that were below poverty, even though they left and went to work.
You said that CDF kind of thinks the Senate version is certainly better than the House version, but are there things, you know, in a perfect world that Children's Defense Fund would like to see in any kind of welfare reform legislation that we haven't already talked about?
What we need to see in welfare legislation that really helps families is to learn from what's happened and encourage those policies that help raise family incomes. And we know that when programs supplement low wages with cash, we know that that helps children. There's data to show it. They do better in school, they have fewer mental health problems, and parents' work is more stable when that happens. We know that when people get more education and training, combined with good job placement services, they can earn more and have more stable jobs. So those kinds of work supports are what families need. We know they need more child care because people can't be expected to leave young children in unsafe, insecure surroundings where their children are not helped to develop. But now only 1 out of 7 eligible families, low-income families, are getting the child care that they're eligible for because there's not enough funding for it. We need to help immigrants who are here legally become eligible again for these services. They lost their eligibility in 1996. But those are some of the things that would make real improvements that would help families get jobs and stay in them.
That was Debbie Weinstein of the Children's Defense Fund. Contact the fund by calling area code 202-628-8787. Or visit their website at www.childrensdefense.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.